Hey, you got the morning show with Aaron, and in the studio I've got Cam. Good morning.
Good morning, Aaron.
We're going to talk about addiction, specifically opiate addiction, and we're going to talk about your story.
Okay.
That's the plan.
That's the plan.
But before we get into it, why are you talking to it? Because this is the thing you do. You don't just want to do it on the radio. You want to do it with other people as well. So why talking about this now?
The main reason is I'm a firm believer in that there's too much silence and too much hush-hush about opiate addiction.
Yeah.
I want to be able to tell my story so that, first of all, so my past addictions and that actually doing some good, some good comes from it. And I want to speak out because the more people that speak out about it, the more it gives the people that are hiding and suffering in silence the confidence or the normality of speaking their problems, their addictions.
Their story.
Their story.
Yeah, so you haven't been using like hard drugs for donkey's age, is
it? Since I was 28, I stopped using the needle.
So that's about 20 years ago.
That's about 20 years ago.
So it was heroin.
It was actually morphine sulfate, and we used to turn it into heroin, freebase heroin, which is diamorphine is the real name for heroin.
Okay. A lot of us don't know.
No. I didn't know before I knew.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of the background about why we're going to talk about it. And but how did it get started, and what age were you when you first started down this path?
Okay, well, like, first of all, I never planned to be a junkie or a user, on a needle. It was just a chain of unforeseen circumstances or events, So my mum had cancer, and from the age of about 12 when she got cancer. And at about 14, I realised that she wasn't taking the morphine. And she was still getting the scripts filled by the doctor because she felt it was an insult to the doctor if she didn't take his medicine, but she didn't. She just... And so I went in the cupboard one day and found a shoebox full of morphine pills.
Right.
And a friend of mine's brother was into them. And so I asked him... Well, actually, I took a handful. Me and my mate took a handful, went out, got really sick. And then, so
it wasn't actually a positive experience?
It wasn't. It was a real horrible experience. I was sick for about a day and a half, just throwing up constantly.
Wow.
Yeah, and I found out later that we had taken far too much and I could have overdosed quite easily.
Yeah.
But then I got hold of my mate's brother and bumped into him and told him that his drug that he was taking was horrible because we'd always heard that he was on it. And he said it was lovely and said, "Oh, your drug's horrible, mate." And he offered to show me how to use it properly.
Ah.
Yeah, and I just turned 15, I think, at that stage, or late 14, and I still remember the experience of my first shot.
Yeah.
I felt actually normal. I remember I had a fear of needles, and we're in this toilet, and I was sitting on the toilet seat, he was standing in the doorway, and I had just put my arm out, and I was looking away. And I felt him blow on my arm, and I just, "Bro, stop blowing on my arm and just get it in there, mate. I just want it done." And he said, "Mate, it's already done, mate." And I turned around and looked at him. I still remember this so vividly. He was standing in the doorway, and he just looked down at me and said, "Ooh, you like it, eh?" And I just said that I felt normal. I didn't feel high at all.
Yeah.
I just felt like how I should feel, like just a warm, comforting feeling,
I've heard people say it's like like having a blanket
it
around
is.
You.
Yep. It's like it's like the unconditional love, warm hug of your mother. It's like they call it mother's milk, and it is like that. It's just the absence of bad. It's not a high. It's the absence of bad that you don't even know you're experiencing.
Because I think for people who don't know anything about it, they expect that you're it's a thrill.
That's right. Yeah, and they see people on TV and that, and like they have heroin and they sort of not. It's called going on the nod. So they're like falling asleep and they can't speak properly. That's people who've had too much.
Right.
So I always had a measured dose. I had a business. I had 7 staff. Throughout my addiction. And
so this is about up until your 20s and after you left school.
So 15, I was already 15. I left school pretty much the day I turned 15 and started full-time work as an apprentice.
Yeah.
Construction sites in Auckland City. And about 6 months after that, I had my own business.
So you could function while you're on it.
Yeah, totally. And I was actually, the misconception of it, because they see, and I can't blame people, because they all they see is what they see on TV. They don't see the average junkie or average user of needles and stuff. And so the people that are having too much, yeah, they nod out and dribble and stuff like that. But if you have the right amount, you can function totally normally. You're healthier than you are when you're not on it, because opiates actually are like a cure-all. You don't get colds, because codeine and stuff is the main function of cold medicines, ingredient, and codeine is a derivative of opium, which is heroin.
So you're painting a very positive picture at this point.
Yeah, and it can be, except two things. It's illegal.
Yeah.
So that gets you in a lot of trouble, obviously. Yeah. It's really expensive. It was costing me $300 a day just to get rid of the withdrawals, not even get high in the end.
Right, because that's the problem, like with most drugs, isn't it?
Yeah, that is. And especially with heroin, because heroin is different to like methamphetamine and LSD and stuff, in the fact that it's physically addictive. And people will say that, methamphetamine is physically addictive, you know, you can't do without it, but it's not until you've been an opiate addict that you know what real addiction is. And you still get the cravings and the want and the all-encompassing need to function with it, like you do on methamphetamine or speed or alcohol. But if you have that as well as pain. It's like the worst food poisoning you've ever had. And every minute seems like, every second seems like an hour. And you know you've got days of the come down and you just feel like you can't do it. Like I tried to go through withdrawals numerous times over the time.
Just cold turkey. Yeah.
And also weaning down. But when it comes to the cutoff point, and it started that 3 days of withdrawal, the actual physical pain, I couldn't handle it, and I tried to commit suicide every time. Mate found me hanging, and the rope broke once, and the guy talked me out of it. And there was the 3 times I tried to give up. And it was just, it's just unbearable. It's like you're turning inside out. And because opiates are actually a pain blocker. So that's what they are. You've got an opiate receptor in your brain that everyone has. And because we've been having it for so long.
And we must make our own opiates.
Well, it's thought that we do have opiate like endorphins,
in our
system,
yeah,
our hormones, but it's actually thought that we've been having it so long as humans, like the Chinese people, and throughout history, we've always used opium as a painkiller and as a medicine, and it's been in humans so long that the brain has actually developed an opiate receptor. The only thing that fits is the opiate molecule, so it's waiting for pain relief.
But what I think something you've told me in the past was that because you're using that, your body does have pain relief mechanisms of its own.
It totally does, yep.
But they stop doing the job because they don't need to anymore.
That's right. So when you, because it's an opiate, because it's a pain reliever, your body doesn't need to make any pain reliever itself, and your pain threshold becomes lower and lower because believe it or not, we're all in pain all the time. Sitting down, if you think about it, your bum's a bit sore, your foot's a bit sore, your leg, your aches.
Yeah.
You know, there's little things that happen. And we have a threshold, a sort of a level where it's sore is, you know, unbearable, or you can cope with the pain. Whereas with heroin, because it blocks the pain receptor, when you don't have it, that pain, the blocker is gone, so everything you do is painful. So the withdrawals is like...
So you can't even just sit still?
No. You sit there and it's like sitting on burning embers. You touch something and it's like touching razor blades and it feels like your skin's inside out. The air hurts on your skin. It's like a newborn baby. When they come out, they've never experienced pain before. And they often relate to it that in rehab, that when a baby comes out, the air, that's why a baby screams, the air on its body, it's building its threshold of pain up. So the air hurts, the breathing hurts, because it's never experienced the actual pain of outside life before.
It's been in the womb. Yeah, that's literally right. The most comfortable place.
Yeah, so when you come off heroin and stuff, that's what you're experiencing, the pain through the roof.
So back to the start, you said you were using your mum's unused morphine. Did she discover that you were doing that?
Unfortunately, and to say right at the bat, mum passed away when I was 18.
Yeah.
So when I was 17, I left a needle. I'd have moved out of home already, but I went home to visit and got some pills and had a shot in the bathroom at parents' house. And I left and left a needle in the sink by mistake. So I got a phone call to come home, and I went home, and yeah, so they had found the needle, and then to look through the morphine, and I had actually gone to the stage of I'd used so many of them that I'd actually gotten Disprins and cut them into a shape of morphine and painted them with nail polish to replace the ones so it didn't look like I'd taken any.
Oh, wow.
And when they had them all tipped out, I saw what I'd used different colour nail polish. I had cut them like so roughly, but at the time when I was high, I thought I was doing a great job, but it was obvious they were not the real pill.
Yeah.
And Mum, that was one of the worst days of my life, seeing Mum's disappointment, and she felt guilty.
Yeah.
Because it was her morphine, but I reassured her it wasn't. I went to please them. I went straight into rehab for 6 months to Odyssey House.
Yeah.
And got out, and then Mum passed away. And I was drug-free for those 6 months in Odyssey House.
Do you think it was a success for that?
Odyssey House is one of the best rehabs I've ever been to. I've been to pretty much all of them. And,
right.
So with Odyssey House, it's a three-year program. Well, it used to be when I was back then. I think it's changed a bit now. I think it's 2 years. But it's total abstinence from drugs. It's like the army. So they lock you up. They don't need you to go out. You don't see any of your relatives or friends for the first 3 months.
But you choose to go.
You can be sentenced there by courts as well.
Okay.
So it's a mix. Yeah. When I was going there was about 150 people at the Bollard Girls Home, which is Odyssey House in Auckland. I thought it was great because it kept you busy. You know, you had chores. The whole place is run by the addicts.
Yeah.
And it was just a real good atmosphere, and it showed you that you could live without drugs. Unfortunately, I didn't want to live without drugs.
Right.
I only went there for my parents, so when I came out, I discharged myself after 6 months and went straight back to the using.
Okay.
Yeah. But then I had to buy it, which was a big difference than for the first few years, 4 years or so, I had it free, and then all of a sudden I had to pay, at that stage, $100 a hit. And although I was working, it still takes $700 a week. It takes a bit out of your pay packet.
Well, this is like the 90s, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. It was early 90s.
So $100 was not quite this. It was more than now.
That's right, yeah. So $700 was a massive. I was self-employed with my own business, so I could afford it. But when the checks didn't come in, I was using material money, the boys' wages, and I was a drinker as well. I was a heavy drinker. Used to drink a lot, like a couple of bottles of 40 ounces. I got up to the stage where I was drinking 2 40 ounces to go out before we went to the nightclubs.
40 ounces of?
Of whiskey.
Right.
Yes, I drank 2 1-litre bottles of whiskey, or 1.25.
So none of that's sustainable, eh?
None of it was sustainable, mate. You can't sustain, there's no way that you can actually, for one, have enough money to do that, to live that life, and it just goes up and up and up. So there's no end to it. At the end, like I say, it was $300 a day, and I couldn't earn that money, so I was wheeling and dealing. I couldn't go to work because I was trying to earn more than I was actually getting at work, even though it was good money, but I needed more than that, so I was wheeling and dealing to get $300 a day every day because work didn't pay till the 20th of the month.
What were you wheeling and dealing?
I was buying drugs and selling them on.
Okay.
And just getting drugs for people and making money out of it and stuff like that to get my hit. And, so it's sort of what happened. Mum dying was a definite a lock on the coffin of addiction for me.
Yeah.
It put me into massive depression, and I slipped my wrists, 117 stitches. And I think I cut 10 times in one arm, 17 in the other, and just wanted to see Mum.
Yeah.
You know, she was everything to me.
Yeah.
And that sort of locked my addiction in. I just used that. Instead of grieving, going to grieving counselling, I just used the heroin.
All right.
Yeah.
So everything's very dark at the moment.
Yep.
How do you have to... They talk about hitting rock bottom before you decide you really want to do something about it.
Yep. Yep. I did that, mate. I got to about 25, 26 and started researching ways to get off the ship.
Yeah.
And I discovered that you had a psychological addiction and a physical addiction.
Okay.
And I had to get rid of both.
Yeah.
It's not just one or the other. So I did a bit of research, and the physical addiction I could deal with later. I knew of a treatment overseas. that I could go for. And so I got on the methadone, which wasn't easy. It was a 2-year waiting list.
Really? Why?
Yeah, back then you had to get approved to go on the methadone. And so it was a registered drug, and only so many people were allowed on it. And so someone had to come off the program for someone to go on the program. And that's just how it was run.
From where I'm sitting, that seems a bit crazy. But anyway, we'll just crazy, take it as given.
Methadone's crazy. You know, they give you methadone's a heroin, and they give you heroin to get off the heroin. You know, so really, they're giving you legal heroin to get off the illegal heroin. But the stuff they're giving you is harder to come off. The addiction, the withdrawals are worse, probably 10 times longer, but it can be regulated, so you don't have to be a criminal, and you can get out of that criminal world and just go to a chemist, and that's what I did. So I drank it properly.
But just back a step, what?
The rock bottom?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the rock bottom was really, for me, the money was one thing, but I could have dealt with that, but it was the fact that I was running out of veins, and it would take me 3 hours to have a shot, and I'd be in the bath in hot water, because you sit in hot water to make your veins swell.
Yeah.
And I'd shot into my neck, my jugular vein, both of them, collapsed both of those, and pretty much every single vein in my body, even below my waist, you know, crutch, eyelids, forehead, I'd used every vein.
Did you look a bit of a mess?
I was pretty scabby. Because it makes you pick an itch, and also pimples and stuff like that. But the track-wise, you only really get tracks if you're using blunt needles. If you're using a new needle every time, there's no such thing as tracks, really, and because I varied the use as well. But I was using a drug called Marzine with methadone or with heroin, which is stuffs your veins, so that stuffed every vein in my body. So it was taking 3 hours to have a hit, and then even after that 3 hours, I'd shot so many times that I'd mixed it with blood and watered down the gear.
Yeah.
So by the time I had the shot, it didn't even get rid of withdrawals. So I had to go out and score again just to get rid of withdrawals so I could not go high, just live.
Yeah.
And that became unbearable. I'd just be sitting there crying in the corner of the bathroom, covered in blood, holes, and it was just over. I was sick of being sick.
So did you have to find the strength to do it, or was it just so motivating in itself that
it was so motivating? I just wanted to get. I knew about that treatment, treatment that we'll talk about in a minute, and but I knew that I had to get on the methadone first and deal with the social, the psychological addiction. So I rang the clinic up every morning for at 7 o'clock in the morning and said, "Can I come in?" And they said, "No, it's a 2-year waiting list." And I rang every day.
Yeah,
and for 6 months, and got to know the lady on the other end of the phone.
Yeah,
and she said, "Why are you ringing?" I said, "Because I want to get on the program, mate. You know, I'm sick of this shit." And she, one day, I rang up. She said, "Oh, look, it's your lucky day. Someone's cancelled an appointment. Come in now."
Yeah.
So I run and got on the methadone, and I used it properly. I drank it every day, unlike most people that are on it.
This is something we don't know, most of us.
Yes. So methadone is abused. And it's abused because people think it's a free high. So, and it is. It's heroin, and they don't need to go out and score it. But methadone is it's diverted. So most people, and I'm not tarring anybody with a brush, but in my experience, most people that are on the methadone are abusing it, and they tend to divert it, it's called diverting, but it's a little cup or something under your collar. And because you have to drink it in the chemist in front of the pharmacist when you first get on it. And people will spit it into a little cup or a container up their sleeve or cotton wool in their mouth and then squirt it out afterwards. And they do that so that they can take it home and boil it down and shoot it up.
Yeah.
And so they're up and down all the time on their doses. And that's why they never get anywhere. You'll still get high on it. But if you have it every day, you won't get high and you can start changing your life.
You can just be normal.
You can be normal, which I was.
That's what you did.
Yep. And at the time, I had bad liver. I had hep C.
You'd contracted that from a needle or something?
I contracted that from shearing the rinsing water out of the needles. It's very... 99% of people who use intravenous drugs once will contract hep C. It lives outside the body for 3 months.
Okay.
And so it's really transmittable. Even if you wash the dishes, a spoon can still have it on 3 months later. Even though it's been through a dishwasher.
Okay, so it's inevitable.
Yeah, and so I had that, and I went to the doctor, and I was sick, and he said to me I had 12 years to live. I was 28. And he said, if you don't stop drinking today, you'll die tomorrow. And the drugs you're using is fucking is stuffing your liver as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to give up then. And so that was when I sort of made the change. I got on the methadone, and I came down to Raglan actually to tell a friend that I had 12 years to live. Yeah. And I never left.
Right.
And changed my life, stayed away from all the addicts. And that got rid of the physical addiction. After 2 years of staying away from triggers, your brain can actually free itself from the want, the need, the psychological addiction of it.
Yeah.
And but I was still physically addicted to methadone.
Yeah. And your health still, because I knew you then sometime after you got to Raglan, and I know that your health wasn't fantastic.
It wasn't fantastic,
mate. You couldn't work like a full week.
No. After a couple of days, Hep C is like a real bad flu or a hangover.
Yeah.
So like you do a, I was working, as you know, a couple of days work, but it would take me 4 days and I'd be in bed for 4 days after that.
Yeah.
And it got to the stage where I probably had a few years left to live of quality life.
Yeah.
I was pretty sick, sicker than I let on. And I knew it was a death sentence because there was no cure for it.
Yeah.
But amazingly enough, a cure was discovered a couple of years before I passed away, and I was chosen to go on the trial for it, that treatment. And so there were a few people in Raglan, and there was a cure. So 6 months of chemotherapy, shooting chemotherapy drugs into my stomach for 6 months, getting down to 6 stone.
You're normally what?
I was 13 at the time.
Okay.
Yeah, I was 13 stone when I was working there, so I lost over half my body weight.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't realise.
Yeah,
it was half.
Yeah. And I stayed pretty much when I was right down under 8 stone. I stayed away from everyone, so no one saw me.
Yeah,
I just felt yeah.
But it did the job. So the chemo treatment got rid of the Hep C.
Got rid of the Hep C. So and it really changed my life. I do digress, but I could go on about it. Caused me to become a zookeeper, which I never wanted to do in my life, but it. Just because I wanted to give back to society, that treatment just led to me becoming a zookeeper. It's a complicated story, but...
which you did in Hamilton for a while.
Hamilton, I was a giraffe and zebra keeper for a couple of years.
Yeah. Now, we've gone over time, but I'm going to keep going because we've got to finish the story and we got time.
Cool.
So you got rid of the disease.
Yeah.
You're still on the methadone.
Yeah.
And you just... Is it a problem just to stay on that for the rest of your life?
It's a major, major problem. And it starts off good, and I can't fault the methadone for giving me the chance to change my life.
Yeah.
And become a normal member of society. But it is liquid handcuffs. It's what the people call it that are on it.
Yeah.
You can't plan anything. You can't go on holiday because you've always got to go. Even after years on it, I would have been on it for 14 years or something like that. And I still had to go to the chemist twice a week. So you get takeaways. You work up to, when they trust you, you get takeaway doses, but you still have to go twice a week minimum.
But they're never going to give you 3 months because it is a serious drug.
They're never
going to
give you 3 days.
Right, yeah. So, like, well, I mean, I say 3 months because...
That's what it's
called. I'm on a conventional prescription that I can get 3 months worth.
Yeah, that's right. And because of what it is, methadone is... people get robbed for it, mugged and, you know, stuff, sell it.
Yeah.
And stuff. So, and they've got to make sure you're still taking it, you know. And I was drug tested throughout all that 14 years for other drugs. So they test you to make sure you're clean.
Yeah.
But I was still on that, and I couldn't, it was just liquid handcuffs. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go on holiday. I couldn't do anything. And I was always worried about the chemist burning down or me missing my dose. And,
right. Yeah. Something. You know, yeah.
Because it's uncontrollable and it's horrible. But I did know of the treatment that I'd researched for since I was 26, and it's a treatment called, which is groundbreaking now because it's hitting the world over the last few years, but it has been around for 20 odd years, and it's called ultra rapid detox under general anaesthetic, and it's RUDOGA or whatever the abbreviation is.
Yeah.
So what they do is they there's a drug called naltrexone or Narcan, which a lot of people know about. It's the antidote for if you're a heroin overdose. If you go into overdose, they give you this stuff, strips all your body of opiates, and you go full withdrawal, and you'll bolt upright, and they actually have to give you a bit of heroin or opiate afterwards
to balance you out,
yeah, right, if you've got a habit. Yeah. And they use it as a preventative for alcoholics as well. If they give you a depot shot of naltrexone or a pill and insert it into your leg, it's an agonist, so it actually makes you sick if you have alcohol or heroin. So that drug there is used at the treatment, and but they put you under general anaesthetic first. So
the whole thing happens while you're out?
While you're out, yes. So they give you a general anaesthetic, and they pump your body full of naltrexone, and you react and go into full physical withdrawal, and they have to hold you down. You pee yourself, you shit yourself, you vomit, you convulse.
It's all on.
It's all on, and it's very violent.
But you're unaware.
Unaware, totally. And like, I had bumps and cuts all over my head, but I've been thrashing around in the hospital bed.
So how many days are you like this?
So what they do is they give it to you, and then over about 8 hours, they'll give you a little bit every hour, and you'll react and react and react, and then they'll think that's enough after 8 hours or so, and they'll give you a little bit of heroin or methadone to calm you down again, and then they'll wake you up. So you wake up, you don't even know you've been through it, and you just feel like you're on your normal dose of methadone, and then they do it again the next night. And then they do it over a series of nights, and it usually takes 3 nights. And by when you don't react to the naltrexone being put into you, they know that you've gone through the physical withdrawals, you wake up, and you're drug-free. And it sounds like, wow, why don't they do this everywhere and get everyone off heroin?
Yes, that is the first thought you have. Why can't we do it? Because where do you have to go?
So I had to go to Serbia to do it, which is no mean feat. And when I originally discovered it and researched it, it was in South Africa. And they used to do it in Australia, but through a lot of logistic nightmares, they banned it around the world because of a couple of deaths, and which was unrelated, but they sort of linked it to the treatment. And because the medical board doesn't really like it, they'd rather people on the methadone, because they've got a stockpile of methadone, they can regulate it and stuff like that, whereas this treatment, people can come off the drug for a party, you know, or they get too out of it and they get a big habit on the drug, and they can go through this treatment. The treatment's expensive.
Yes.
So it was €25,000 to do this treatment.
So you'd known about this since you were about 26.
Yep.
You did it when you were about 46?
46, 40, yep, that's right.
And so
I wanted to do it, and it was cheaper when it was in South Africa and Australia. But just when I got the $6,000, which was what it was to do, I'd finally saved up enough money, borrowed a bit off my dad and my sister. They banned the treatment. And then it was only in Europe, only in Serbia, which was €25,000. So that sort of put a halt to everything. And I thought, oh, well, I'm going to be on methadone forever. And luckily, or amazingly, a stranger came in. I was telling that story to a stranger at work.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I'll pay the $25,000. And I said, no, because that's weird.
Yeah.
And strings and stuff. And I was seeing a counsellor at the time, or a counsellor. And she said, yeah, that sounds dodgy. And the lady came in to work probably once a week for 6 months and just kept asking me if I wanted the money. I kept saying no. And then she said I was insulting her for not taking it.
So is this something she normally did?
She said she was a philanthropist. Yeah. Money was no object to her and nothing to her. And she just liked to help people.
Right.
And she said that need help and can, you know, get progress and not hand up, not a handout.
Yeah.
And so after 6 months, she said I was insulting her, and I told that to my counsellor, and my counsellor advised me, we had a bit of a talk, and she agreed that I should take the money.
Right.
So I said yes, and the lady came back into work an hour later with a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah. And so I, by myself, went over to the treatment centre in Serbia, and it was hard on my body.
You had quite a rough time, didn't you?
I had a rough time.
More than some people might.
Yeah. And it was mainly because I was drinking it properly. So if you take methadone as prescribed, it's it lasts 48 hours in your system, but they give it to you every 24 hours, and that's so that you reach a plane and it becomes the norm and you're not getting high off it, not getting low. You're just staying at that, and it masks all other opiates.
Yeah.
So that's the reason they give it to you. And I was having it like that. I wasn't going up, wasn't going down, wasn't stealing it or shooting it up. And because of that, it soaked into my body. And the surgeon, because at the clinic you have a team of surgeons, a psychologist, psychiatrist, anesthetist, massage therapist, doctor, and so you, for $25,000 you're getting state of the art. This is the best treatment center in the world.
It won
last year and the year before for the most successful and scientifically advanced rehab in the world. They have linked addiction to trauma and only trauma.
Well, this is a big discussion which we haven't even got into yet.
Yeah, that's right.
We have. I've talked about this on the radio before, that they're now the people doing the research are believing that it's addiction is related to trauma. It doesn't just randomly happen to people because they had a drug once.
No, that's right. And no one wants to become a drug addict. People take drugs to get high. The misconception to everyone, you know, oh, that junkie deserves is, you know, to be in the gutter. But he actually wanted to get high one day when he was 15, like me.
Yeah.
And it just turned into, never thought of getting addicted, you know, and it just happened. And all of a sudden I was an addict. People get prescribed morphine for a broken leg. And all of a sudden, they're an addict, and it's not their fault. No one.
There was a big scandal in the US about OxyContin.
Yeah. And that's here now. So OxyContin and oxycodone.
I've actually had some of that.
Wow. Oh yeah. Did you like it?
not like you did.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it was because I had a toothache, and the normal treatment would have.
They gave you that, did they?
Because I was on another drug that wouldn't have worked with their normal painkillers.
Okay, right.
So they're like, okay, we're going for the big guns now. And I had a really, really nasty toothache. And I just, like you said.
Oh, this was recent?
A couple of years ago. Three years ago. Yeah, I just felt very normal.
Yeah. Like just content and.
Yeah. That's all it was.
Yeah. And that's all it is. And that's the exact scenario.
But I don't normally feel really bad.
No.
So it wasn't like a big difference to me, I think.
Like if you had had more, if that pain had carried on for a month, they would have been giving you those oxynorms, and then when your pain went away and they said, okay, you don't need the script anymore, you would have had to go through withdrawals.
Yeah, and that's what's happened to people in the US, but we're getting a little sidetracked.
Yeah, we are.
So you had the treatment in Serbia.
Yep, and the treatment in Serbia is that gets rid of the physical addiction.
Yeah.
But there's two parts to it in Serbia, and I didn't go on one part of the treatment, which was an extra money, but they actually cure addiction. Which is a big statement. But they actually use regression therapy to take you back to the trauma that they think caused your addiction.
Yeah.
And they do that by giving you drugs like ayahuasca, DMT, and Ibogaine. And the psychologist leads you through your trauma. And once you've relived your trauma, this is their theory, and it seems to be proven right around the world, that once you remember your forgotten or repressed trauma in your life, then your brain can start dealing with it, and the trauma can go from a hidden pocket in your brain to actually being processed, and you can deal with it and overcome it, and at least deal with it. And by doing that, you get rid of the trauma, which gets rid of the addiction. So it's a whole course in our soul from that trauma, and that treatment can fill that.
And I've played talks by Gabor Mate, who's a doctor in Canada, who's in Canada, who's doing that as well.
And the one I went to was Dr. Vorobiev. If anyone wants to look it up, Dr. Vorobiev in Serbia.
But you didn't do this because...
I didn't do it because after you relive your trauma, you're obviously very upset and you need support. And I was on the other side of the world by myself.
Yeah.
So they weren't willing to give it to me in case I couldn't handle it.
Do you still feel you need that? I mean, you've kind of controlled your addictions for 20 years.
Yeah. I'm a work in progress. So I don't mean to preach. I'm not saying that I'm above anyone else, that I'm an angel or anything like that. You know, I still am an addict. You know, I have an addictive personality, and even if I'm drug-free for 30 years, I will still be an addict.
Okay.
Because I have... I can't say no, really. I'll take a drug and I'll think, why the hell shouldn't I take it again?
But you have been saying no.
Yes, I have been, but I still use, I have ups and downs. They say rehab and, they say that, you know, having drugs again is part of the rehab. I can't remember the phrase now. It's relapse is part of rehab. They call it that. And so I do smoke marijuana every now and again and take some things
Because you still use, and then you cut your own sentence off. You're not saying you still use heroin.
No. I totally... So that treatment that I went on, it can is good. The Bagani and Ibogaine and ayahuasca part of it, the cure addiction, will work for any drug. But the physical detox that I went on is strictly for opiates.
Right.
Because the other drugs aren't physically addictive. Everyone thinks that, because methamphetamine's around a lot at the moment, people think that it's physically addictive and that kind of thing. But if you get sleep, if you have 5-6 days sleep,
you'll be okay.
You'll be okay. Yeah. I went for that treatment, and it's changed my life. You know, like I'm off the methadone now, no liquid handcuffs.
Yeah.
And it's given me the freedom to actually do what I want to do, which is talk and live without a handcuffs tying me to a chemist.
Yeah.
I did a bit of a blurb to Odyssey House in Auckland, which is, and the thing I went through was Odyssey House UK, and it's a story about my life. And so what they're doing now is getting ex-addicts to go around schools at high-risk drug areas, prison release, so people coming out of prison that have been addicts, and then after 20 years in prison, they think, shit, they're too scared to leave prison because they think they're going to become an addict again.
Yeah.
And so people talking about how they've changed their life and they have become drug-free, it gives people hope. And so I've released the blurb and I've been accepted to go around and do talks at schools. Probably next year I'll start. And just talk to people, telling your story. And it just opens people's eyes to what's involved in addiction, because a lot of people don't realise. You know, they think, "Oh, I'll just have a shot, and that'll be it." But or I'll never be a heroin addict. You know,
that won't happen to me.
That won't happen
scenario
to me.
Scenario that you always say when you're young.
That's right. But through even what you were saying about your medicine, that could have caused you to become a heroin addict. You know, like you would have come off. You might not have been able to handle the withdrawals off the oxy, so you start buying them.
Yeah.
And then, they're actually not doing much anymore. I need more. I can't afford it, so I'll shoot them up.
I was also on an antibiotic to get rid of the infection, which took a few days, so it was only for a few days.
Okay. Oh, yeah, what are you saying?
3-4 days.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was short term.
Yeah. I tell you, it takes 3 days to become addicted to an opiate.
Okay. So not for me.
No. Well, probably, but it's because you're low dose. You wouldn't have noticed the withdrawals, probably, you know.
Like I said before, there's been this huge controversy in the US about that drug OxyContin and people getting really their lives turned upside down.
And now the new one is fentanyl. And that's used here quite often, quite a lot. I had it in the back of the ambulance when I went for an ambulance ride. They gave it to me.
Why were you in an ambulance?
I had a spider bite.
Oh, that's right. That happened recently, the spider bite. Yeah.
And they gave me an inhaler for the pain. And they inhaled this thing. And I said, "What's that?" And they said, "Oh, it's fentanyl." And fentanyl was like 100 times stronger per weight than heroin.
Were you very happy about that?
Not happy, because my tolerance is so high, even after all these years, I didn't feel it. And I didn't, if I'd have felt it and liked it, I don't think I would use again. I've pretty much got control. I was just sick of opiates. I'm over that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know if I'd have, you know, like I don't even take codeine now. Not because I'm scared that I might relapse, but just because I don't want to take opiates anymore.
Yeah.
It's the addiction is gone. Like, and that's a good thing about, like I was saying, getting rid of the psychological addiction of a drug, or alcohol is the same. It is physically addictive, alcohol. Barbiturates, Valiums and stuff like that are some of the hardest ones to come off. And more people are addicted to Valium than any other drug. And it's dangerous. You know, like you can overdose on Valium just with a bit of alcohol. And so they're all physically addictive, and getting rid of that psychological addiction, the triggers and that, is key to getting off your habit.
Well, we should wrap up. Yes, I'm curious. No, that's all right. I'm in charge of how much time I take. I know there's a DJ doing 10 minutes, though. But the work that they're doing in Serbia, is that starting to get credibility in the eyes of people around the rest of the world? Because we know how, like, establishment situation always can take decades for people to accept that something's okay like that.
And it has taken decades, because Dr. Vorobiev actually came up with this treatment in South Africa, like when I was 26, 25. Yeah. I saw a documentary actually on 48 Hours.
Yeah.
On the show that used to be on TV, and it was followed a guy through that treatment. And even once they had perfected it, it wasn't until Dr. Vorobiev won the Betty Ford Award for most successful and advanced clinic in the world a couple of years ago, that the Western Medicine Society started to pick up on it and go, "Oh, it must be all right.
this treatment. They kind of need that kind of...
And so he went... And South Africa, because they're a bit outside the FDA sort of thing, or the World Medicines, they can do sort of what they want a little bit. Because of the apartheid issues they had, they were a bit outside the box. And
isolated.
Yeah, but once that was all given back, and it all started to be, for lack of a better term, a white man society again.
Yeah.
A mixed race society again.
Yeah.
Then the Western medicines took over, and so he had to move out of South Africa. Went to Serbia, and because they're Eastern Bloc, they can do what they want, and that's why they get so advanced. The clinic I went to was so advanced that they used to laser washed your blood.
I don't even know what that is, but it sounds fancy.
They put a laser in your vein and wash your blood.
So what do you say for people who are stuck at the moment? What do you tell them? Like, just briefly before we go.
I tell them that don't give up.
Yeah.
There is hope, and hope is real, and I'm proof of the hope is real. You know, I've been to the bottom. I've been there. If anyone's sitting there and doing what I was doing, trying to find that vein, thinking that's all they can do, they've got no hope of getting off the ship. Well, there is hope, and that treatment is breaking world concepts or regimes on counselling and stuff. They're realising that counselling doesn't work as well as they thought it did, and the studies prove that that people telling their stories and ex-addicts telling their stories and not telling people to use drugs or not use drugs, it's not our business. We've got no right to tell people. Just telling your story, and it just triggers something in someone's mind. They go, oh, I didn't know that would happen if I became an addict. And that will more likely to shut them down and not cause them to use the drug than if someone at the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff saying, you shouldn't have used that. You know,
I feel like we should give... I think I've got a thing over here. Have we got... I was thinking the number to call.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not
dissing NA and all that either. They are good relative. A 12-step program, you know.
Monday night, 7 o'clock at the community house, you can meet NA.
Yeah.
Community Alcohol and Drug Service, maybe.
Yeah, CADS.
Yeah, Hamilton number, 834-6902. I just want to leave people with that. 834, I've turned away from the page. 6902.
And if anyone, I'm happy to talk to people in detail if they want to come through you.
Yeah, okay.
Even if they want to talk in private, as anonymous, if they want to know about the treatment or want advice or anything, I do mentoring online for a peer support group and Addicts Supporting Addicts.
Okay.
So if they want to look up those things or contact you, I'm happy to give advice to anybody.
Well, folks, you can usually get our details just online, but you can also call the studio 825-2981. So we've been talking to Cam, and a story of hitting rock bottom and getting back up again and getting life back to normal. You feel like you have a normal life now?
As normal as anyone else.
Yeah, but this is true. Yeah, he really has a normal life, but
hope is real. That's what I've got to say.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for coming in, man.